Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist, lifelong Avengers comic book reader, and today a massive head cold sufferer. And our guest today is Bill Cotter. Bill is a writer who has authored many books and is widely recognized as an expert on early Disney television, including The Wonderful World of Disney and one of my favorite TV series, Zorro.
Oh, yes.
We're excited to have him on our show because he's also an expert on world's fairs, including the 1939 and 1964 New York World's Fairs that inspired much of the Stark Expo that Steve and Bucky visit in these minutes of the movie. Many of Bill's books are published through the Images of America series, whose sepia-toned trade dress you'd instantly recognize if you'd ever breezed through a bookstore or gift shop near a place with any interesting history, which is to say everywhere. Welcome, Bill.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it. With that introduction, I'm going to have to get my head back down.
Not at all. We are so excited to have you. As we discussed before we started, we all know you and know your books, and so happy you could join us. Hal, what's happening in this minute?
All right, minute 16. In the medical exam room, a nurse whispers to the doctor. He glances at Steve Rogers, a scrawny young man eager to enlist. "Wait here," the doctor says, exiting swiftly. "Is there a problem?" Steve asks, confused. "Just wait here," the doctor repeats, disappearing. Dr. Abraham Erskine enters, dismissing a military police officer. "Thank you," he says, then faces Steve. "So you want to go overseas, kill some Nazis?" "Excuse me," Steve replies, startled. "Dr. Abraham Erskine, I represent the Strategic Scientific Reserve," Erskine says, offering a handshake. "Steve Rogers," Steve answers, shaking his hand. "Where are you from?" "Queens, 73rd Street and Utopia Parkway. Before that, Germany," Erskine says with a faint smile. And there we are.
Wow. And we wind up in Queens at 73rd Street and Utopia Parkway, which is about 5 miles down the Long Island Expressway from the subject today of the New York World's Fair. Bill, the four of us all have something in common, is that we have this really uncomfortable obsession with the World's Fair and both World's Fairs. And possibly even the ash dump that it was before, and how it turned into a mecca for so many people that are interested in not only the history, but also the way that the future looked at both fairs. I mean, when Brian has said this before on previous shows, that when people came to the 39 World's Fair, everybody had a different idea of what the future was going to look like. But when we came out of the 39 World's Fair, it was a common view. We saw what General Motors showed us of the future. And that kind of was further impressed on us when we went to the 64, 65 World's Fair. Can you tell me how much of the future, I mean, it's a difficult question, but how much of our view of the future do you feel was formed by both World's Fairs?
That's a good question. You mentioned Futurama. Obviously, it was the most successful show at both World's Fairs. So I think General Motors had a big issue in pushing cars and driving. Out here in L.A., I live in Los Angeles these days. I wish we still had more trains and stuff, but they got rid of them so people would buy more cars. But, hopefully someday we'll get some of our trains back. But yeah, I think back then, I think people were looking for a world of something better. Because if you look in 39, you're coming out of the Depression. In 64, you've got the Cuban Missile Crisis and everything's bad. So you go into the World's Fair and there's somebody telling you, hang on, it's going to be great. You're going to love it. The world's going to be super. The cars will drive themselves. The robots will clean your living rooms. I think a lot of people came out of there saying, wow, this is not so bad, so great right now. But there's something to look forward to. I mean, if you went to the World's Fair and said, oh man, this is as good as it gets, forget it. It's, people wouldn't be real happy. But both fairs sold a real message of optimism and the fact that things were good today, but they're going to be great tomorrow. And My parents have gone a number of times to the 39th fair, and that's the message they kind of came out of it. And then I discuss it a lot with my folks about the 64. Same sort of thing about it, hang in there, things are on their way uphill. And when you get sold a positive message, every pavilion you go to, good, 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 great, good, good, you come out thinking life's going to be pretty good.
Yeah, I think especially in 39, because people knew there was war coming. I mean, it had already started in some parts of the world. And 39-40 was a pretty grim time when I think a little optimism might have been exactly what people needed.
Yeah, my mom made a point. We were back at the World's Fair ground, and I think about 89 for a show, and we were walking around. Of course, I'm remembering where this was and that was, and she says, no, it was here, it was there, because we're talking two different fairs. But she was actually at the fair the day Italy went into World War II, and she said that they made an announcement, they played the Italian national anthem, they turned off the lights in the Italian pavilion. And she said, as a kid, she just knew the world was going to be different. And, they didn't know how different or why, but you could just tell was coming. And you had some nations that, like Czechoslovakia, had a pavilion, but the people that worked there had no country to go home to when the fair ended. So yeah, it was definitely a time that everybody knew a storm was coming, but nobody knew just when it was going to break and how bad it was going to be.
You know,
Well.
in retrospect, Bill, it would be easy to look at that 39 fair in particular and think, well, because of that, that it's sort of ill-timed, or you might even have like a sort of a bitter view at it. Oh, they said everything was going to be great, but the whole world was at war, and as we've said, already starting by the time of the start of the fair. But is it, it? It sounds to me like it is. Is it your take that dose of optimism? And things are going to get better. Did that help people cope with sort of the coming war? Did it give them a little bit to sort of look back on and remember? Because from 1939 to 1945, so much of the world was saying, it's got to be better when this is over. We've got to make it through. We've got to make it through. But boy, it looks tough.
Yeah, I think it's like the thing, I guess, the calm before the storm. Well, this was the storm before the calm. It's coming. World War II delayed a bunch of things. I mean, it in some ways it helped things along with like aviation. The advances in flying. I own a World War II airplane, so it probably wouldn't have been built if it wasn't for. Yeah, I see you looking there,
Yes.
'86 Texan.
Oh, a
So.
T6, wonderful.
Yeah, great plane in between gas bills.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but no,
Terrific
I think
airplanes.
you had the situation where people the war was a blip. I mean, luckily, it didn't hit us in America the way it hit other countries in their homelands. So for a lot of people, there was a time of shortages, but it wasn't a time where your house was likely to fall down on your head. So I think people saw, during the war, it's not so great, but we know we're going to win. We're convinced the right will make, right will make might. We'll win it, and we're going to get through it. So, and at the end, all these things that were promised, the promise is still going to come. It's just going to be delayed a bit.
Yeah, to Hal's point, I also, my observation, if that's not original, is that these times of political tumult and war and strife and so forth often are among the most creatively expressive periods in a culture's history. You know, I mean, 38, 39 is when some of the greatest movies ever made were done. Music was fantastic. You, same for 64. I mean, it was a burgeoning cultural explosion of art and music and movies and film and all of this. They sort of seem to go together, that when something is chaotic or tumultuous somewhere, it breeds creativity elsewhere.
Yeah, I think people look for diversion, and that's why I spent most of my career in the movie business. I always felt that no matter how bad things get, you have a bad day at the office or things are bad or whatever, you go home, you turn on the TV, you go to a movie, and it's escapism. And I basically devoted most of my career to escapism, and it's worked out well. It's kept me from getting depressed.
Well, that and flying a T6 now and again, as you said, between gas bills.
Yeah.
I was wondering, as we were talking about the two fairs, 39, 64, quarter century apart, but the buildup from to get to the 39 fair. I mean, you had things going on in San Francisco, San Diego in 33, I guess the Texas Centennial in 36. This all seemed to be swelling as to what kind of themes would be shown at the World's Fair. Would you say that like the 39 fair was its own creature, or did it evolve from the previous fairs that of that decade?
I think it really evolved in tremendous part from the 33-34 Chicago World's Fair. When the folks in Chicago, it was the bankers and the hotel people that wanted a fair in Chicago, and the government people, the leaders there, didn't want it. But when they put out a thing where if you bought tickets to basically buy a share in the fair, and you came with a ticket book. So people were sending in their money, and kids were sending in dimes and quarters and everything, and all of a sudden this groundswell started going. And the Chicago Fair became so popular and so successful that it went a second year. It was only supposed to go one year. And in New York, I think they were looking at the same thing that we if Chicago can do it, we in New York, of course, can do it better. But let's go off and give this a try. And they had more of the politicians in New York that were behind it because again, every politician always wants to ride a train to success. And if the 33 Chicago Fair was a big thing, New York's going to be even bigger. So it just took on more and more momentum. Then when they picked Grover Whalen to run the fair, I think that was a wonderful thing for New York to do because Grover was the sort of guy that knew everybody and could twist everybody's arm and get everybody on board. So all of a sudden, if you were in New York, you were for the fair. And if you weren't for the fair, the city bureaucracy would turn on you. So you went with it. Unlike some other fairs like New Orleans, the city leaders didn't want it, and that went bankrupt. But that's a whole nother story.
Well, was Grover Whalen the Tony Stark of the 39 Fair? Tony Stark is he's a technical genius, which Whalen was not, but he's also depicted in the film as the motivating force, the brain power, the man who made this thing happen. Was that Whalen?
Yeah, he was he had all sorts of jobs in New York. He was a former police commissioner and all sorts of other jobs. And he had gotten the job, which would be a great job to have, as the official greeter of New York, because they didn't know where to put him after a while. Because Grover, I think, the guy that had a lot of great dreams, but not a lot of wonderful execution. So you put him in a department, he makes a bunch of speeches, and then you realize I need to put him someplace else and someplace else. And that's what happened with the fair. He came in and got the fair built, but it was losing money, so they got rid of him. But Grover was the official greeter, so if you were flying in on the Clipper and you were some movie star, they'd be Grover taking you out to dinner. Or if you were the Queen of Prussia or whatever, Grover would take you out to dinner. So again, super connected, and you really needed a public face like that to come out and do it. And you had a lot of guys behind the scenes, but the head of like Chase Manhattan Bank, who knows him, right? I mean, the guy's a big mover shaker. Snaps his finger, men's jump, but the average person is not going to go and buy tickets because they had a Chase Manhattan or Manhattan Factors Hanover or any of these banks. So you get a guy like Grover that was in all the society papers, Luella Parsons, all these people writing about Grover seen here, Grover doing that. It was a wonderful move to put him in place to get the fair going and to get the cheerleaders.
I have to, sorry, I have to self-correct because otherwise, Jim, I'm going to make you edit this in later.
Yes, I know.
I said Tony Stark, and of course, the fair in the movie is put on by his father, Howard Stark.
Right.
So
Yeah, Howard.
I don't want the Marvel people coming after me
Oh, they
because of
will.
that flub. Carry on, please.
I'm
I
sorry,
was thinking.
Brian. I already reported you. Is
Yeah,
that should I
yeah.
should
The
I have
Marvel police
waited
are coming.
until
So.
one brain fart and you're out of the club?
I worked on the Iron Man the Stark Expo sequence, and I'm going, okay, I'll let him have that.
Well, I keep thinking about if you're famous enough to wind up to ha have Groucho Marx include you in a song, then Grover was part of the Lydia the Tattooed Lady,
Yeah.
so it's he definitely had notoriety. How would you compare him to on the 64 World's Fair with Robert Moses's involvement?
Boy, night and day, really, really night and day. Grover was the sort of guy who would come up to from, and again, I never met him, but reading everything about him, come up, buy you a dinner, twist your arm, cajole you and everything. And Robert Moses, the sort of guy, would threaten you if you didn't do it, he'd go out of his way to crush you. And that's why Robert ended up with a lot of problems, in his impact with the press and the government, everything. So I think they were, as one guy's affable, the other guy's irritable and mercurial. So, two totally different personalities, but they were the right personalities for each fair at the right time. I mean, Moses made a lot of mistakes running and building the 64 fair, but he got it done in a time where, the unions were an issue. Okay, he took care of the unions because he overpaid them. They were happy. They were making money, so they stayed out of his way. He got what he wanted, and somebody else probably would have taken a different approach. But the two guys, I think, were absolutely night and day personality different, but they both got their job done.
Yeah, I think Robert Moses, his motive in life was my way or the highway, and he did have a lot of highways. So it's I'm sorry, Hal, you were about
Oh
to.
yeah, I was Bill. I was going to ask, and this is a, I think maybe a difficult question I don't know that there's an easy answer, but I'm curious about your take on how would you describe with both fairs, but I think in particular the 39, since that's the kind of the analog we're working with here in this scene in the film. How do you describe the impact of that on the country when we talk about things that influence pop culture now? I mean, we've got infinite amounts of streaming channels, and everybody's an influencer, and we have social media, and we've got opportunities to sort of consume content and be involved with news from infinite directions. But things were obviously a lot more narrow in 39. I mean, this is even before the days when, that all of us remember as kids, when you could watch anything on TV as long as it's on one of three channels. There was just so what was that impact like at a time when we weren't inundated with choices of sort of things to do and things to learn about and things to think about?
Well, I think, first of all, the 39 fair, there were two fairs underway. There was one in San Francisco, and which is a much smaller one, and there was one in New York. And I don't think many people from California went to the New York fair and vice versa. And in between, I don't know if they went to either of the two of them. But I think the 64, sorry, 39 fair was pretty much up and down the East Coast, and the whole power structure that went there with New York and Baltimore and Washington, D.C., and even maybe out as far as Chicago, that this was a big burgeoning part with the ship traffic over to England and Europe, and now planes are being able to make the trip nonstop and everything. So I think that it was really a time in which, again, everybody's trying to push the thing that the United States has really come out of the depression. We've really done okay. And we're at the World's Fair. You could see all these futuristic homes. That you're not going to be living in the tenements in the apartments. You're going to have a house which has air conditioning and has all these wonderful things. And you're going to have a robot maid and even and robot butler's even going to have his own robot dog. So everything was, it's all going to be really, really good. And I think it was really a good thing for optimism that, the depression was really, really bad, but boy, we took this garbage dump in Queens, and we got rid of all the rats and the muskrats and everything else, and built the world of tomorrow. We could do anything we want. And I think when people, even if they didn't go to the fair, they saw the pictures of the Trianon, the perisphere, and that whole great, thing laid out, that vista of it. You had to feel pretty proud that your country pulled that off and was able to do that. When so many people had hard times, even just getting a job and feeding the family just a few years before. So I think it really, if the depression hadn't been before, I don't think the fair would have been quite as an eye opener. But I think coming out of absolute darkness into this world of light, I think it was a real, spiritual kick for a lot of people.
Oh, Bill, as we mentioned in a previous episode, I think I wrote a book, a graphic novel called Whatever Happened to World of Tomorrow. And one of the theses of my book is that the 39 Fair marks a transition of America from largely agrarian to more technological. It's sort of the dividing line between old America and modern America. And I'm not saying the fair did that. I think World War II would have done that if nothing else did. But I think it's where people saw their first televisions, their first robots, their first fax machine, for God's sake, all these modern appliances that they would soon have in their own homes. Do you think there's something to that, or should I just destroy all copies of that book and take it off the shelves?
You
I
can't have
burn
my
them all.
copy.
I burn them all. Right? No, I think you're right. It's really the things we take for granted. Sitting here in my office, I got two phones, two cell phones. I got landlines and everything. Back in '39, one of the big things the Bell system did was give you a ticket where you could win a free long distance phone call, because most people had never made a long distance phone call. And a lot of people didn't even have phones in their houses, or they had party lines, or you'd have to go down to the drugstore. So they're telling you everybody's going to have a telephone, and you go, no, no way. I mean, or everybody's going to have a TV. Oh my goodness, and so everybody's going to have a car. Everybody's going to have, so everybody's going to have everything. And I think everybody was like, yeah, I want into that. I want some of everything. And I think that was a big selling point. There were so many things, again, you take for granted today. Bakelite plastic, oh, big thing. We're gonna have all these portable. Remember, the radios used to be gigantic, big wood things. Now, a small little radio, you can sit on top of a table in the living room and listen to Amos and Andy or Bob Hope or whatever. Everything was getting smaller, better, faster. It was a time of tremendous technological change in this country. And you mentioned about the difference from agrarian. They did have a farm at the World's Fair. But even there, Firestone is now going to take you off your antiquated old of tractors and put you on rubber tractor tires, and your farming days are going to be so much easier. And we're going to have automatic milkers at the Borden Pavilion. So even things are agricultural, technology is going to make all that good for you guys, and for everybody, farmer, businessmen, everybody, the world was going to be better. And the World's Fair was here to show you how that's coming real soon.
Bill, I know that the 64 or 65 New York Fair was it was not the last World's Fair by any stretch of the imagination. We've had other things since then. In my mind, as just an enthusiast and aficionado, it was I think of it as sort of the last great fair, and I hope that's not insulting to anybody who loves Montreal or Spokane or some of the others. But why do you think we've moved away from that? And is in Can you imagine, can you envision a point in our modern time where something like this could happen again?
Yeah, I don't. I think we moved away for a couple of reasons. First of all, is that jet travel became pretty easy. When I was growing up, and I grew up in Brooklyn. I mean, for an exciting day, we would go to Queens or something. Now, for an exciting day, people go to Monaco. I mean, it became the whole concept. Like, I went to the World's Fair, and I had never been out of the tri-city area there. But now you could go in and you could see a pavilion, and they're talking to people from Germany. Or you go to the Israel Pavilion or the France Pavilion or whatever. And that was really cool to think about, people from around the world. Today, you can be doing what we're doing on Zoom. You could talk to anybody around the world as easy as talking to your next door neighbor. And you can go to so many places. I think the real thing that became the big end of the World's Fair, because every World's Fair, basically at its heart, is industrial. I mean, you can give it the great thing, the peace through understanding or anything like that. The whole thing is get people come to my city, buy my stuff, invest in my businesses. Well, today, if you came up with something, and I was talking to somebody about this the other day, if you came up with a new iPhone and you showed it at the World's Fair, by the time before the people got to the parking lot, there'd be somebody who would be cloning it and making it and doing something new. So you had the Bell system at that point talking about the picture phone, and they were so far in advance of what everybody else was doing, nobody else could copy them. Today, everything happens so fast. That's why when Apple comes up with something, they always say, okay, it's available tomorrow. They don't tell you what their plans are for 6 months down the road, or some guy in Taiwan or mainland China is going to say, I've got it, sort of thing. So I think we've lost a lot of the incentive for World's Fairs. Because the companies, you would never, it takes about 4 to 5 years from the time you decide to build a World's Fair to the time you open the gate. Any idea that you have today, what your product line is going to be 5 years from now, you're wrong. It's not going to be. It's going to be something different. So things like the Bell system with your giant floating wing, and you get into the whole history of communications and everything. Today, what would you do? What would you be selling? First of all, you hope your company's still around in 5 years. I mean, think about like Kodak and some of these things. Oh my goodness,
Do you think it might have been replaced by Epcot. I mean, when I think of a World's Fair, Epcot to me is like a permanent World's Fair. And as you were saying, the problem when you go there, even like if you go to the Magic Kingdom and you're going to Tomorrowland, it starts looking quaint because all of these things were what was the future in 1982. And it's like, yes, we do have a cell phone. And yes, you know, if you're on the Carousel of Progress, you're going, oh, gee, look, they've got cable.
My favorite ride.
And I think, I mean, it becomes a beloved thing. I mean, one of the something that I learned from being on your Facebook page and getting a CD is listening to 1964 Gene Shepherd going to the World's Fair and making fun of how it's a great big beautiful tomorrow and tomorrow is just a dream away. And he would make these jokes about the whole thing, and eventually he winds up being the voice, the narrator of the Carousel of Progress now, you know, at the Magic Kingdom. And it's like it's full circle. He can't, you know, it's like what was future is now blessed nostalgia, which, you know, I think we're all involved with here with the World's Fair.
Yeah, I don't know if Epcot put it into World's Fair. So I hope not, because I worked on Epcot and that was my Imagineering days.
Oh, wow.
But you know, it's funny you talk about, you know, predictions of the future. When the Carousel of Progress came out, there's a great big beautiful tomorrow, and so everything's going to be good. Well, when they moved it to Florida, they decided they wanted to do something different because GE at that time didn't say, "Don't wait for tomorrow. We wanted you to buy our stuff today." You know, so don't wait for tomorrow's TV. So they changed the song, you know, to whatever it was, the Great Big Beautiful Tomorrow, to Now Is the Time. It became the song. And so they were trying to tell everybody, don't wait, buy its stuff today. Now is the time. You got to get it. It's really good. And after a number of years, they finally decided to put that song back. And it was funny. I went out to dinner with Dick and Bob Sherman, and they had just gotten back from announcing the song was coming back in Florida. And this lady, Dick was like kind of down. I said, "Dick, what's bothering?" He goes, "Ah, oh, you can't win." I said, "What happened?" He goes, "This lady was complaining because we put in a great big beautiful tomorrow." And she says, "No, the song I grew up with is Now Is the Time." You know, it's all what you grew up with, and it's all relative, you know. But he had said, "I've worked for 10 years to get rid of that song, and she wants it back."
Someday I hope to be cool enough to be able to drop a line like when I had dinner with Dick and Bob Sherman.
No kidding.
I tell you, I was lucky. I started at Disney at the right time, and a lot of the guys are still around. And we joke at times about, you know, having I had the Shermans over here at the house. Somebody wanted to have a party, but their mother didn't want them to have a party for 200 people. So I let them have it at my house, and was sitting there with Dick Sherman doing a song fest on my daughter's keyboard in the living room. And I go, oh, if I only had a video camera at the time. But like I said, I was very lucky. When I worked at Disney, I met some absolutely, truly wonderful people, including my wife at Disney. So lots of happy memories. And the fair took me from, I mean, I went to the fair as a 12-year-old kid, and I loved it. I loved Mr. Lincoln and everything. And then I left. I went to college, and I was working at Cape Kennedy. And we had a day off we weren't expecting, and everybody else went over to Disney to play golf. And I went over to something to do, and I said, "Oh, there's Mr. Lincoln. There's the Carousel of Progress." And I went and bought a tie, applied for a job, and the next thing I know, Disney's moving me to California and changing. So it worked out, you know, ways you don't expect.
Wow, an e-ticket all the way.
Amen.
Absolutely.
We'll translate that for our younger listeners later.
Yes, what an e-ticket
What an
was.
e-ticket is.
We have younger
Yeah.
listeners.
Oh
Wow.
my gosh.
Well, still here in LA, it's still a vernacular people appreciate.
That's good to know.
Well, Bill, thank you so much for being a part of our show. I think this whole show is probably eventually going to turn into a World's Fair minute, because every conversation seems to circle around and wind up at the Unisphere. But I do appreciate having the opportunity to talk to you about this. It is one of our favorite topics, and it's great to talk to somebody else who's just as obsessed. I'd also like to thank our audience for joining us. If this is your first time joining us here, please don't forget to subscribe, leave a like at whatever podcast streaming service you found this episode. Also, if you'd like to continue the conversation, we're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
Do this all day.